wished I hadn't come. I was still in last night's clothes, stale and crumpled, which made me feel even worse. I sniffed quietly and wiped my nose with a paper napkin while staring at the mug in front of me. Outside, life in Manhattan continued, oblivious, fast-moving, ignoring the detritus that piled up in the gutter. "What do I do now, Will?" I thought, a huge lump rising in my throat. As if on cue, my phone pinged. "What the bloody hell is going on?" wrote Nathan. "Call me, Clark." And despite myself, I smiled. Nathan said there was no bloody way I was going to stay in a bloody hostel, in bloody God knew where, with the rapists and the drug dealers and God knew what. I was to wait until 7:30, when the bloody Gopniks had left for the bloody dinner, and I was to meet him at the service entrance, and we would work out what the hell to do next. There was quite a lot of swearing for 3 text messages. When I arrived, his anger was uncharacteristically undimmed. "I don't get it. It's like they just ghosted you. Like a ruddy mafiosi code of silence. Michael wouldn't tell me anything other than it was a matter of dishonesty. I told them I'd never met a more honest person in my bloody life, and they all needed their heads looking at. What the hell happened?" He had shepherded me into his room off the service corridor and closed the door behind us. It was such a relief to see him, it was all I could do not to hug him. I didn't, though. I thought I'd probably clutched enough men in the last 24 hours. "For Christ's sakes, people! Do you want a beer?" "Sure." He cracked open 2 cans and handed one to me, sitting down on his easy chair. I perched on the bed and took a sip. "So, well?" I pulled a face. "I can't tell you, Nathan." His eyebrows shot somewhere towards the ceiling. "You too? Oh, mate, don't tell me you... Of course not. I wouldn't steal a tea bag from the Gopniks. But if I told you what really happened, it would... It would be disastrous for other people in the house. It's complicated." He frowned. "What? Are you saying you took the blame for something you didn't do?" "Sort of." Nathan rested his elbows on his knees, shaking his head. "This isn't right."
"I know.
Someone's got to say something. You know he was thinking about calling the cops." My jaw might have dropped. "Yeah, she persuaded him not to, but Michael said he was mad enough to do it. Something about an ATM?"
"I didn't do it, Nathan."
"I know that, Clark. You'd make a crack criminal. Worst poker face I ever saw."
He took a swig of his beer.
"Damn it. You know, I love my job. I like working for these families. I like old man Gopnik. But every now and then it's like they remind you, you know? You're basically just expendable. Doesn't matter how much they say you're their mate and how great you are, how much they depend on you, yada, yada, yada. The moment they don't need you anymore or you've done something they don't like, bang, you're out the door. Fairness doesn't even come into it." It was the longest thing I'd heard Nathan say since I got to New York. "I hate this, Lou. Even knowing so little, it's clear to me you're being shafted. And it stinks."
"It's complicated."
"Complicated."
He gazed at me steadily, shook his head again, and took a long swig of his beer.
"Mate, you're a better person than I am."
We were going to order takeout, but just as Nathan was climbing into his jacket to head off to the Chinese restaurant, there was a knock at the door. We looked at each other in horror, and he motioned me into the bathroom. I skidded in and closed the door silently behind me, but as I stood wedged up against his towel rail, I heard a familiar voice.
"Clark, it's okay, it's Ilaria," said Nathan.
A moment later, she was in her apron, holding a pot with a lid on.
"For you, I hear you talking." She held the pot towards me. "I made it for you. You need to eat. It's the chicken you like, with the pepper sauce."
"Aw, mate!"
Nathan clapped Ilaria on the back. She stumbled forwards, recovered, and placed the pot carefully on Nathan's desk.
"You made this for me?"
Ilaria was prodding Nathan in the chest.
"I know she does not do this thing, they say. I know plenty. Plenty that goes on this apartment."
She tapped her nose.
"Oh, yes."
I briefly lifted the lid. Delicious smells seeped out. I suddenly remembered I had barely eaten all day.
"Thanks, Ilaria." "I don't know what to say."
"Where you go now?"
"I haven't got a clue."
"Well, you're not staying in a hostel in bloody Bensonhurst," Nathan said. "You can stay here for a night or two to sort yourself out." "I'll lock my door." You won't say anything, will you, Ilaria?
She pulled an incredulous face, like it was stupid of him even to ask.
She's been cursing your woman all afternoon, like you wouldn't believe. She said she sold you down the river. She made them a fish thing for dinner that she knows they both hate. I tell you, mate, I've learned a whole new bunch of swear words today.
Ilaria muttered something under her breath. I could only make out the word puta. The easy chair was too small for Nathan to sleep in, and he was too old-fashioned to countenance me sleeping in it, so we agreed to share his double bed with an arrangement of cushions down the middle to protect us from accidentally touching each other in the night. I'm not sure who was more ill at ease. Nathan made a great show of shepherding me into the bathroom first, making sure I'd lock the door, and waiting for me to get into bed before he emerged from his ablutions. He was in a T-shirt and striped cotton pyjama bottoms, and even then I didn't know where to look.
"Bit weird, eh?" he said, climbing in.
Yes. I don't know if it was shock or exhaustion or just the surreal turn of events, but I started to giggle, and then the giggle turned into tears, and before I knew it I was sobbing, hunched over in a strange bed, my head in my hands.
"Oh, mate."
Nathan plainly felt awkward, hugging me while we were actually in bed together. He kept patting my shoulder and leaning in towards me.
"It'll be all right."
"How can it be? I've lost my job and my place to live, and the man I loved. I'll have no references because Mr. Gopnik thinks I'm a thief, and I don't even know which country I belong in." I wiped my nose on my sleeve. "I've messed up everything again, and I don't know why I even bothered trying to be something more than I was, because every time I do it, it ends in disaster."
"You're just tired.
It'll be all right.
It will."
"Like it was with Will."
"Oh, that was completely different. Come on."
Nathan hugged me then, pulling me into his shoulder, his big arm around me. I cried until I couldn't cry anymore, and then, just as he said, exhausted by the day's and night's events, I must have fallen asleep. I woke 8 hours later to find myself alone in Nathan's room. It took me a couple of minutes to work out where I was, and then the previous day's events hit me. I lay under the duvet for a while, curled up in a fetal ball, wondering idly if I could just stay there for a year or two, until my life had somehow sorted itself out. I checked my phone. 2 missed calls and a series of messages from Josh that seemed to have come through in a clump late the previous evening.
"Hey, Louisa! Hope you're feeling okay. Kept thinking about your dance and bursting out laughing at work. What a night. Jay. Kiss. You okay? Just checking you did make it home and didn't take another nap in Times Square. Winky face. Jay. Kiss. Okay, so now it's gone 10:30. I'm gonna guess you headed to bed to sleep it off. Hope I didn't offend you. I was just kidding around. Give me a call. Kiss."
That night, with its boxing match and the glittering lights of Times Square, already seemed a lifetime ago. I climbed out of bed, showered and dressed, setting my belongings in the corner of the bathroom. It limited the space somewhat, but I thought it was safer, just in case a stray Gopnik happened to poke a head around Nathan's door. I texted him to ask when it would be safe for me to go out, and he sent back, "Now, both in study." I slipped out of the apartment and down to the service entrance, walking swiftly past to Shook with my head low. He was talking to a delivery man, but I saw his head spin and heard his, "Hey, Louisa!" But I'd already gone. Manhattan was frozen and grey, one of those bleak days when ice particles seem to hang in the air. The chill pierces your bones, and only eyes, occasionally noses, are visible. I walked with my head down and my hat rammed low over my head, not sure where I was going. I ended up back at the diner, reasoning that everything looked better after breakfast. I sat in a booth by myself and looked out at the commuters with somewhere to go, and forced down a muffin because it was the cheapest, most filling thing on the menu, trying to ignore the fact that it was claggy and tasteless in my mouth. At 9:40 a text arrived. Michael. My heart leapt.
"Hi, Louisa. Mr. Gopnik will pay you to the end of the month in lieu of notice. All your health care benefits cease at that point. Your green card is unaffected. I'm sure you understand this is obviously beyond what he was required to do, given the violation of your contract, but Agnes intervened on your behalf. Best, Michael."
"Nice of her," I muttered. "Thank you for letting me know," I typed. He didn't respond further.
and then my phone pinged again.
Okay, Louisa, now I'm worried I did do something to upset you. Or maybe you got lost, headed back to Central Park. Please give me a call.
Jay, kiss. I met Josh near his office, one of those buildings in Midtown that are so tall that if you stand on the sidewalk and look up, a little part of your brain suggests you should probably topple over. He came striding towards me, a soft grey scarf wrapped around his neck. As I climbed off the small wall I had been sitting on, he walked straight up and gave me a hug.
I can't believe this. Come on. Oh, boy, you're freezing. Let's go grab something warm for you to eat.
We sat in a steamy, cacophonous taco bar, two blocks away, while a constant stream of office workers filed through and servers barked orders. I told him, as I had Nathan, the bare bones of the story. I can't really say any more, just that I didn't steal anything. I wouldn't. I've never stolen anything. Well, apart from once when I was 8. Mum still brings it up occasionally if she needs an example of how I nearly ended up on a path to a life of crime. I tried to smile. He frowned.
So, does this mean you're going to have to leave New York?
I don't really know what I'm going to do, but I can't imagine the Gopniks are going to give me a reference, and I don't know how I can support myself here. I mean, I don't have a job, and Manhattan hotels are a little out of my price range. I have looked online, and the diner at local rentals and nearly spat out my coffee. The tiny room I had felt so ambivalent about when I first arrived with the Gopniks turned out to be affordable, only with an executive salary. No wonder that cockroach hadn't wanted to move.
Would it help you to stay at mine?
I looked up from my taco.
Just temporarily, and it doesn't have to mean a whole boyfriend-girlfriend thing. I have a sofa bed in the front room. You probably don't remember.
He gave me a small smile. I had forgotten how Americans actually genuinely invited people into their homes, unlike English people who would issue an invitation but emigrate at short notice if you said you were going to take them up on it.
That's really kind, but Josh, it would complicate things. I think I might have to go home for now at least, just till another position comes up.
Josh stared at his plate.
Timing sucks, huh?
Yep.
I was looking forward to more of those dances.
I pulled a face.
Oh, God, the dance thing, Do I want to ask you what happened the other night?
You really don't remember. Only the Times Square bits. Maybe getting into a taxi.
He raised his eyebrows. Oh, Louisa Clark. It's pretty tempting to start teasing you here. But nothing happened. Like that, anyway.
Unless licking my neck is really your thing.
But I wasn't wearing my clothes when I woke up.
That's because you insisted on removing them during your dance. You announced, once we got to my building, that you would like to express your last few days through the medium of free-form dance. And while I followed on behind, you shed items of clothing from the lobby to the living room.
I took my own clothes off.
And very charmingly, too. There were flourishes. I had a sudden image of myself twirling, a coy leg thrust out from behind a curtain, the feel of cool window glass on my backside. I didn't know whether to laugh or cry. My cheeks a furious red, I covered my face with my hands.
I have to say, as a drunk, you make a highly entertaining one.
And when we got into your bedroom?
Oh, by that stage you were down to your underwear, and then you sang a crazy song, something about a monkey or a malahonky or something. Then you fell asleep, very abruptly, in a little heap on the floor. So I put a t-shirt on you and put you in my bed, and I slept on the sofa bed.
I'm so sorry.
And thank you.
My pleasure. He smiled and his eyes twinkled.
Most of my dates are not half that entertaining.
I dipped my head over my mug. You know, these last few days I've felt like I'm permanently about 2 degrees from either laughing or crying, and right now I slightly want to do both.
Are you staying at Nathan's tonight?
I think so.
Okay. Well, don't do anything hasty. Let me put a few calls in before you book that ticket. See if there are any openings anywhere.
You really think there might be? He was always so confident. It was one of the things that most reminded me of Will.
There's always something. I'll call you later.
And then he kissed me. He did it so casually that I almost didn't register what he was doing. He leant forward and kissed me on the lips, like it was something he'd done a million times before, like it was the natural end to all our lunch dates. And then, before I had time to be startled, he let go of my fingers and wound his scarf around his neck. "Okay, I gotta go. A couple of big meetings this afternoon. Keep your chin up." He smiled, his high-wattage perfect smile, and headed back to his office, leaving me on my high plastic stool, my mouth hanging open. I didn't tell Nathan what had happened. I checked in with him by text that it was okay to come home, and he told me the Gopniks were headed out again at 7, so I should probably leave it till 7:15. I walked in the cold and sat in the diner and finally returned home to find Ilaria had left me some soup in a thermos and 2 of the soft scones they called biscuits. Nathan was out on a date that evening and gone in the morning when I woke. He left me a note to say he hoped I was okay and reassured me that it was fine for me to stay. I only snored a little bit, apparently. I'd spent months wishing I had more free time. Now that I had it, I found the city was not a friendly place without money to burn. I left the building when it was safe to do so, and walked the streets until my toes grew too cold, then had a cup of tea in Starbucks, stretching that out for a couple of hours, and using the free Wi-Fi to search for jobs. There wasn't much for someone with no references, unless I was experienced in the food industry. I began to layer up, now that my life did not involve mere minutes spent in the open air, between heated lobbies and warm limousines. I wore a blue fisherman's jumper, my workman's dungarees, heavy boots and a pair of tights and socks underneath. Not elegant, but that was no longer my priority. At lunchtime, I headed for a fast food joint where the burgers were cheap and nobody noticed a solitary diner eking out a bun for another hour or two. Department stores were a depressing no-no, as I no longer felt able to spend money, although there were good ladies and Wi-Fi. Twice, I headed down to the vintage clothes emporium, where the girls commiserated with me but exchanged the slightly tense looks of those who suspect they're going to be asked a favour. "If you hear of any jobs going, especially like yours, can you let me know?" I said, when I could no longer browse the rails.
"Sweetheart, we barely make rent or we'd have you here like a shot."
Lydia blew a sympathetic smoke ring at the ceiling and looked at her sister, who batted it away.
"You'll make the clothes stink."
"Look, we'll ask around," Angelica said. She said it in a way that made me think I was not the first person who had asked. I trudged out of the shop feeling despondent. I didn't know what to do with myself. There was nowhere quiet where I could just sit for a while, nowhere that offered space where I could work out what to do next. If you didn't have money in New York, you were a refugee, unwelcome anywhere for too long. Perhaps, I mused, it was time to admit defeat and buy that plane ticket. And then it hit me. I took the subway up to Washington Heights and got off a short walk from the library. It felt, for the first time in days, like I was somewhere familiar, somewhere that welcomed me. This would be my refuge, my springboard to a new future. I headed up the stone steps. On the first floor, I found an unoccupied computer terminal. I sat down heavily, took a breath, and for the first time since the Gopnik debacle, I closed my eyes and just let my thoughts settle. I felt some long-held tension ease away from my shoulders and let myself float on the low murmur of people around me, a world away from the chaos and bustle of outside. I didn't know if it was just the joy of being surrounded by books and quiet, but I felt like an equal here, inconspicuous, a brain, a keyboard, just another person searching for information. And there, for the first time, I found myself asking what the hell had just happened anyway. Agnes had betrayed me. My months with the Gopniks suddenly felt like a fever dream. Time out of time, a strange compacted blur of limousines and gilded interiors, a world onto which a curtain had been briefly drawn back, then abruptly closed again. This, in contrast, was real. This, I told myself, was where I could come each day until I had worked out my strategy. Here I would find the steps to forge a new route upwards. "Knowledge is power, Clark."
"Ma'am?"
I opened my eyes to find a security guard in front of me. He stooped so that he was looking directly into my face.
"You can't sleep in here."
"What?"
"You can't sleep in here."
"I wasn't sleeping," I said indignantly.
"I was thinking." "Maybe think with your eyes open then, huh? Or you gotta leave."
He turned away, murmuring something into a walkie-talkie. It took me a moment to register what he had really been saying to me. 2 people at a nearby table looked up at me and then away.
My face flushed. I saw the awkward glances of other library users around me. I looked down at my clothes. My denim dungarees, with the fleece-lined workman's boots, and my woolen hat. Not quite Bergdorf Goodman, but hardly Vagrant City.
"Hey, I'm not homeless," I called out at his departing back.
"I have protested on behalf of this place, mister. I am not homeless." Two women looked up from their quiet conversation, one raising an eyebrow. And then it occurred to me. I was.
Chapter 22. Dear Ma, sorry it's been a while since I've been in contact. We're working round the clock on this Chinese deal here, and I'm often up all night coping with different time zones. If I sound a bit jaded, it's because I feel it. I got the bonus, which was nice. I'm sending Georgina a chunk so she can buy that car she wants. But over the last few weeks, I've realised ultimately I'm not really feeling it here anymore. It's not that I don't like the lifestyle, and you know I've never been afraid of hard work. I just miss so many things about England. I miss the humour. I miss Sunday lunch. I miss hearing English accents, at least the non-phony kind. You would not believe how many people end up plummier than Her Madge. I like being able to pop across for weekends in Paris or Barcelona or Rome. And the expat thing is pretty tedious. In the goldfish bowl of finance here, you just end up running into the same faces whether you're in Nantucket or Manhattan. I know you think I have a type, but here it's almost comical. Blonde hair, size zero, identikit wardrobes, off to the same Pilates classes. So here's the thing. Do you remember Roop, my old friend from Churchill's? He says there's an opening at his firm. His boss is flying out in a couple of weeks and wants to meet me. If all goes well, I might be back in England sooner than you think. I've loved New York, but everything has its time, and I think I've had mine. Love, W. Kiss. Over the next few days, I rang up about numerous jobs on Craigslist, but the nice-sounding woman with the nanny job put the phone down on me when she heard I had no references, and the food server jobs were already gone by the time I called. The shoe shop assistant position was still available, but the man I spoke to told me the wage would be $2 an hour lower than advertised because of my lack of relevant retail experience, and I calculated that would barely leave me enough for travel. I spent my mornings in the diner, my afternoons in the library at Washington Heights, which was quiet and warm. Apart from that one security guard, nobody eyed me like they were waiting for me to start singing drunkenly or pee in a corner. I would meet Josh for lunch in the noodle bar by his office every couple of days, update him on my job-hunting activities, and try to ignore that, next to his immaculately dressed go-getting presence, I felt increasingly like a grubby sofa-hopping loser. "You're going to be fine, Louisa. Just hang on in there," he would say, and kiss me as he left, like somehow we had already agreed to be boyfriend and girlfriend. I couldn't think about the significance of this, along with everything else I had to think about, so I just figured that it was not actually a bad thing, like so much in my life was, and could therefore be parked for now. Besides, he always tasted pleasingly minty. I couldn't stay in Nathan's room much longer. The previous morning, I had woken with his big arms slung over me and something hard pressing into the small of my back. The cushion wall had apparently gone awry, migrating to a chaotic heap at our feet. I froze, attempted to wriggle discreetly out of his sleeping grasp, and he had opened his eyes, looked at me, then leapt out of bed as if he had been stung, a pillow clutched in front of his groin.
"Mate, I didn't mean... I wasn't trying to..."
"No idea what you're talking about," I insisted, pulling a sweatshirt over my head. I couldn't look at him in case it... He hopped from foot to foot.
"I was just... I didn't realise I..." "Oh, mate. Oh, jeez."
"It's fine. I needed to get up anyway." I bolted and hid in the tiny bathroom for 10 minutes, my cheeks burning while I listened to him crashing around and getting dressed. He was gone before I came out. What was the point in trying to stay after all? I could only sleep in Nathan's room for a night or two more at most. It looked like the best I could expect elsewhere, even if I were lucky enough to find alternative employment, was a minimum wage job and a cockroach and bedbug infested flat share. At least if I went home, I could sleep on my own sofa. Perhaps Trine and Eddie were besotted enough with each other that they would move in together, and then I could have my flat back. I tried not to think about how that would feel. The empty rooms and the return to where I had been 6 months earlier. Not to mention the proximity to Sam's workplace.
Every siren I heard passing would be a bitter reminder of what I had lost. It had started to rain, but I slowed as I approached the building and glanced up at the Gopniks' windows from under my woolen hat, registering that the lights were still on, even though Nathan had told me they were out at some gala event. Life had moved on for them as smoothly as if I had never existed. Perhaps Alari was there now, vacuuming or tutting at Agnes's magazines, scattered over the sofa cushions. The Gopniks and this city had sucked me in and spat me right out. Despite all her fond words, Agnes had discarded me as comprehensively and completely as a lizard sheds its skin, and not cast a backward look. If I had never come, I thought angrily, I might still have a home and a job. If I had never come, I would still have Sam. The thought caused my mood to darken further, and I hunched my shoulders and thrust my freezing hands into my pockets, prepared to head back to my temporary accommodation, a room I had to sneak into, and a bed I had to share with someone who was terrified of touching me. My life had become ridiculous, a looping bad joke. I rubbed my eyes, feeling the cold rain on my skin. I would book my ticket tonight, and I would go home on the next available flight. I would suck it up and start again. I didn't really have a choice. Everything has its time. It was then that I spotted Dean Martin. He was standing on the covered carpet that led up to the apartment building, shivering without his coat on, and glancing around as if deciding where to go next. I took a step closer, peering into the lobby, but the night man was busy sorting through the packages and hadn't seen him. I couldn't see Mrs. DeWitt anywhere. I moved swiftly, leant down and scooped him up before he had time to grasp what I was doing. Holding his wriggling body at arm's length, I ran in and swiftly up the back stairs to take him back to her, nodding at the night porter as I went. It was a valid reason for being there, but I emerged from the stairs onto the Gopniks' corridor with trepidation. If they returned unexpectedly and saw me, would Mr. Gopnik conclude I was up to no good? Would he accuse me of trespass? Did it count if I was on their corridor? These questions buzzed around my head as Dean Martin writhed furiously and snapped at my arms. "Mrs. DeWitt," I called softly, peering behind me. Her front door was ajar, and I stepped inside, lifting my voice. "Mrs. DeWitt, your dog got out again." I could hear the television blaring down the corridor, and took a few steps further inside. "Mrs. DeWitt!" When no answer came, I closed the door gently behind me and put Dean Martin on the floor, keen not to hold him for any longer than I had to. He immediately trotted off towards the living room. "Mrs. DeWitt?" I saw her leg first, sticking out on the floor beside the upright chair. It took me a second to register what I was seeing. Then I ran round to the front of the chair and threw myself to the floor, my ear to her mouth. "Mrs. DeWitt," I said, "can you hear me?" She was breathing, but her face was the blue-white of marble. I wondered briefly how long she had been there. "Mrs. DeWitt, wake up! Oh, God, wake up!" I ran around the apartment looking for the phone. It was in the hallway, situated on a table that also housed several phone books. I rang 911 and explained what I had found. "There is a team on its way, ma'am," came the voice. "Can you stay with the patient and let them in?"
"Yes, yes, yes, but she's really old and frail, and she looks like she's out cold. Please come quickly."
I ran and fetched a quilt from her bedroom and placed it over her, trying to remember what Sam had told me about treating the elderly who had taken a fall. One of the biggest risks was their growing chilled from lying undiscovered for hours, and she felt so cold. Even with the full blast of the building's central heating, I sat on the floor beside her and took her icy hand in mine, stroking her gently, trying to let her know somebody was there. A sudden thought crossed my mind. If she died, would they blame me? Mr. Gopnik would testify that I was a criminal after all. I wondered briefly about whether to run, but I couldn't leave her. It was during this tortured train of thought that she opened an eye. "Mrs. DeWitt?" She blinked at me, as if trying to work out what had happened.
"It's Louisa, from across the corridor. Are you in pain?"
"I don't know. My wrist," she said weakly.
"The ambulance is coming. You're going to be okay. It's all going to be okay."
She looked blank at me, as if trying to piece together who I was, whether what I was saying made any sense. And then her brow furrowed.
"Where is he? Dean Martin, where's my dog?"
I scanned the room. Over in the corner, the little dog was parked on his backside, noisily investigating his genitals. He looked up when he heard his name and adjusted himself back into a standing position. "He's right here. He's okay." She closed her eyes again, relieved.
Will you look after him if I have to go to the hospital?" "I am going to the hospital, aren't I?"
"Yes, and of course."
"There's a folder in my bedroom that you need to give them. On my bedside table."
"No problem. We'll do that." I closed my hands around hers, and while Dean Martin eyed me warily from the doorway, well, me and the fireplace, we waited in silence for the paramedics to come. I travelled to the hospital with Mrs. DeWitt, leaving Dean Martin in the apartment as he wasn't allowed in the ambulance. Once her paperwork was done and she was settled, I headed for the lavery, reassuring her that I would look after the dog. I would be back in the morning to let her know how he was doing. Her tiny blue eyes filled with tears as she issued croaking instructions as to his food, his walks, his various likes and dislikes, until the paramedic shushed her, insisting that she needed to rest. I caught the subway back to Fifth Avenue, simultaneously bone-weary and buzzing with adrenaline. I let myself in using the key Mrs. DeWitt had given me. Dean Martin was waiting in the hallway, standing four square in the middle of the floor, his compact body radiating suspicion.
"Good evening, young man. Would you like some supper?"
I said, as if I were his old friend, and not someone vaguely expecting to lose a chunk out of one of my lower legs. I walked past him with simulated confidence to the kitchen, where I tried to decipher the instructions as to the correct amount of cooked chicken and kibble that I had scribbled on the back of my hand. I placed the food in his dish and pushed it towards him with my foot.
"There you go. Enjoy."
He stared at me, his bulbous eyes sullen and mutinous, forehead rippling with wrinkles of concern.
"Food! Yum!"
Still, he stared.
"Not hungry yet, huh?" I said.
I edged my way out of the kitchen. I needed to work out where I was going to sleep. Mrs. DeWitt's apartment was approximately half the square footage of the Gopniks, but that wasn't to say it was small. It comprised a vast living room with floor-to-ceiling windows overlooking Central Park, its interior decorated in bronze and smoked glass, as if it had been done some time around the days of Studio 54. There was a more traditional dining room, packed with antiques sporting a layer of dust, which suggested it hadn't been used in generations. A melamine and formica kitchen, a utility room, and four bedrooms, including the main bedroom, which had a bathroom and sizable dressing room leading off it. The bathrooms were even older than the Gopniks, and let loose unpredictable torrents of spluttering water. I walked round the apartment with the peculiar, silent reverence that comes with being in the uninhabited house of a person you don't know very well. When I reached the main bedroom, I drew a breath. It was filled, 3.5 walls of it, with clothes neatly stacked on racks, hanging in plastic from cushioned hangers. The dressing room was a riot of colour and fabric, punctuated above and below by shelves with piles of handbags, boxed hats and matching shoes. I walked slowly around the perimeter, running my fingers along the materials, pausing occasionally to tug gently at a sleeve or push back a hanger to see each outfit better. And it wasn't just these two rooms. As the little pug trotted suspiciously after me, I walked through two of the other bedrooms and found more. Row upon row of dresses, trouser suits, coats and boas in long, air-conditioned cupboards. There were labels from Givenchy, Bieber, Harrods and Macy's, shoes from Saks Fifth Avenue and Chanel. There were labels I had never heard of, French, Italian, even Russian, clothes from multiple eras, neat little Kennedy-esque boxy suits, flowing caftans, sharp-shouldered jackets. I peered into boxes and found pillbox hats and turbans, huge jade-framed sunglasses and delicate strings of pearls.
They were not arranged in any particular order, so I simply dived in, pulling things out at random, unfolding tissue paper, feeling the cloth, the weight, the musty scent of old perfume, lifting them out to admire cut and pattern. On what wall space was still visible above the shelves, I could just make out framed clothes designs, magazine covers from the 50s and 60s, with beaming, angular models in psychedelic shift dresses, or in possibly trim shirt waisters. I must have been there for an hour before I realized I hadn't located another bed. But in the fourth bedroom, there it was, covered with discarded items of clothing. A narrow single, possibly dating back to the 50s, with an ornate walnut headboard, a matching wardrobe and chest of drawers. And there were four more racks of the more basic kind you would find in a changing room, and alongside them, boxes and boxes of accessories, costume jewellery, belts and scarves. I moved some carefully from the bed and lay down, feeling the mattress give immediately as exhausted mattresses do. But I didn't care. I would basically be sleeping in a wardrobe. For the first time in days, I forgot to be depressed. For one night at least, I was in Wonderland. The following morning, I fed and walked Dean Martin, trying not to be offended by the way he travelled the whole way down Fifth Avenue at an angle, one eye permanently trained on me, as if waiting for some transgression. And then I left for the hospital, keen to reassure Mrs. DeWitt that her baby was fine, if permanently braced for savagery. I decided I probably wouldn't tell her that the only way I'd been able to persuade him to eat was the great Parmigiano-Reggiano onto his breakfast. When I arrived at the hospital, I was relieved to find her a more human pink, although oddly unformed without her familiar makeup and set hair. She had indeed fractured her wrist and was scheduled for surgery, after which she would be in the hospital for another week due to what they called complicating factors. When I revealed that I wasn't a member of her family, they declined to say more.
"Can you look after Dean Martin?"
she said, her face creased with anxiety. He had plainly been her main concern in the hours I had been gone.
"Perhaps they could let you pop in and out to see him in the day. Do you think Ashok could take him for walks? He'll be terribly lonely. He's not used to being without me."
I had wondered whether it was wise to tell her the truth, but truth had been in short supply in our building lately, and I wanted everything out in the open. "Mrs. DeWitt," I began, "I have to tell you something. I don't work for the Gopniks anymore. They fired me." Her head moved back against her pillow a little. She mouthed the word as if it were unfamiliar. "Fired." I swallowed. "They thought I had stolen money from them. All I can tell you is that I didn't. But I feel it's only right to tell you because you may decide that you don't want my help."
"Well," she said weakly.
And again,
"well."
We sat there in silence for a while. Then she narrowed her eyes.
"But you didn't do it."
"No, ma'am."
"Do you have another job?"
"No, ma'am. I'm trying to find one." She shook her head.
"Gopnik is a fool. Where are you living?"
I looked sideways. I'm actually staying in Nathan's room for now. But it's not ideal. We're not, you know, romantically involved. And obviously the Gopniks don't exactly know."
"Well, it sounds like an arrangement that might suit us both rather well. Would you look after my dog? And perhaps conduct your job hunting from my side of the corridor? Just till I come home?"
"Mrs. DeWitt, I'd be delighted!" I couldn't hide my smile.
"You'll have to look after him better than you did before, of course. I'm going to give you notes. I'm sure he's terribly unsettled."
"I'll do whatever you say."
"And I'll need you to come here daily to let me know how he is. That's very important."
"Of course." With that decided, she seemed to subside a little with relief. She closed her eyes.
"No fool like an old fool," she muttered.
I wasn't sure if she was talking about Mr. Gopnik, herself, or someone else entirely. So I waited until she had fallen asleep, then headed back to her apartment. All that week, I devoted myself to the care of a boggle-eyed, suspicious, cranky 6-year-old pug. We walked 4 times a day. I grated Parmesan onto his breakfast, and several days in, he ceased his habit of standing in any room I was in and staring at me with his brow furrowed, as if waiting for me to do something unmentionable, and simply lay down a few feet away, panting gently. I was still a little wary of him, but I felt sorry for him too. The only person he loved had vanished abruptly, and there was nothing I could do to reassure him that she would be coming home again. And, besides, it was kind of nice to be in the building without feeling like a criminal. Ashok, who had been away for a few days, listened to my description of this turn of events with shock, outrage, and then delight. "Man, it's lucky you found him. He could have just wandered off, and then nobody would have known that she was even on the floor," he shuddered theatrically. "When she's back, I'm going to start checking on her every day, making sure she's okay." We looked at each other. "Nothing would make her more furious," I said. "Yep, she'd hate it," he said, and went back to work. Nathan pretended to be sad that he had his room back to himself, and brought my stuff over with almost unseemly haste to save me a journey of approximately 6 yards. I think he was just wanting to be sure I was really going. He dropped my bags and peered around the apartment, gazing in amazement at the walls of clothes. "What a load of junk," he exclaimed. "It's like the world's biggest Oxfam shop. Boy, I'd hate to be the house clearance company having to go through this lot when the old lady pops her clogs." I kept my smile fixed and level. He told Ilaria, who knocked on my door the next day, for news of Mrs. DeWitt, then asked me to take her some muffins she had baked. "The food in these hospitals would make you sick," she said, patted my arm and left at a brisk trot before Dean Martin could bite her. I heard Agnes playing the piano from across the hall. Once a beautiful piece that sounded relaxed and melancholy, once something impassioned and furious. I thought of the many times Mrs. DeWitt had hobbled across and furiously demanded an end to the noise. This time, the music ended abruptly without her intervention, Agnes seemingly slamming her hands down on the keys. Occasionally I would hear raised voices, and it took me a few days to convince my body that my own adrenaline didn't need to rise with them, that they no longer had anything to do with me. I passed Mr. Gopnik just once in the main lobby. He didn't see me, then performed a double take, apparently primed to object to my presence there. I lifted my chin and held up the end of Dean Martin's lead. "I'm helping Mrs. DeWitt with her dog," I said, with as much dignity as I could manage. He glanced down at Dean Martin, set his jaw, then turned away as if he hadn't heard me. Michael at his side glanced at me, then turned back to his mobile phone. Josh came on Friday night after work, bringing takeout and a bottle of wine. He was still in his suit, working late all week, he said. He and a colleague were competing for a promotion, so he was there for 14 hours a day, and planned to go in on Saturday too. He peered around the apartment, raising his eyebrows at the decor. "Well, dog-sitting was one job opening I certainly hadn't considered," he observed as Dean Martin trailed suspiciously at his heels. He walked around the living room, slowly picking up the onyx ashtray and the sinuous African woman sculpture, putting them down, peering intently at the gilded artwork on the walls. It wasn't top of my list either. I laid a trail of doggy treats to the main bedroom and shut the little dog in until he'd calmed down. But I'm really okay with it. "So how are you doing?" "Better," I said, heading to the kitchen. I had wanted to show Josh I was more than the scruffy, intermittently drunk job seeker he had been meeting the past week. So I had dressed up in my black Chanel-style dress with a white collar and cuffs, and my emerald fake crocodile Mary Janes, my hair sleek and blow-dried into a neat bob. "Well, you look cute," he said, following me. He put his bottle and bag on the side in the kitchen, then walked over to me, standing just a couple of inches away so that his face filled my vision. "And, you know, not homeless, which is always a good look. Temporarily, anyway. So does this mean you'll be sticking around a little longer?" "Who knows?" He was mere inches from me. I had a sudden sensory memory of burying my face in his neck a week previously. "You're going pink, Louisa Clark." "That's because you're extremely close to me." "I do that to you?" His voice dropped, his eyebrow lifted. He took a step closer, then put his hands on the worktop at either side of my hips. "Apparently, I said, but it came out as almost a cough, and then he dropped his lips to mine and kissed me. He kissed me and I leant back against the kitchen units and closed my eyes, absorbing the mint taste of his mouth, the slightly strange feel of his body against mine, the unfamiliar hands closing over my own. I wondered if this was what it would have been like to kiss Will before his accident, and then I thought that I would never kiss Sam again, and then I thought that it was probably quite bad form to think about kissing other men when you had a perfectly nice one kissing you at that very moment. And I pulled my head back a little, and he stopped, and he looked into my eyes, trying to gauge what it meant. "I'm sorry," I said. It's just all kind of soon. I really like you, but..."
"But you only just broke up with the other guy,
Sam, who is clearly an idiot and not good enough for you. Josh." He let his forehead tip forward so that it rested against mine. I didn't let go of his hand. "It just all feels a bit complicated still. I'm sorry." He closed his eyes for a moment, then opened them again.
"Would you tell me if I was wasting my time?" he said.
"You're not wasting your time. It's just... it was barely 2 weeks ago.
There's a lot that's happened in those 2 weeks."
"Well then, who knows where we'll be in another 2 weeks?"
"You said we."
"I suppose I did." He nodded as if this were a satisfactory answer.
"You know," he said almost to himself, "I have a feeling about us, Louisa Clark, and I'm never wrong about these things."
And then, before I could respond, he let go of my hand and walked over to the cupboards, opening and closing them in search of plates. When he turned around, his smile was brilliant.
"Shall we eat?"
I learnt a lot about Josh that evening. I learnt about his Boston upbringing, the baseball career his half-Irish businessman father had made him give up because he felt that sport would not secure a long-lasting income. His mother, unusually among her peers, was an attorney who held on to her job throughout his childhood and in their retirement years. Both his parents were adjusting to being in the house together. It was apparently driving them completely nuts.
"We're a family of doers, you know? So Dad has already taken on some executive role at the golf club, and Mom is mentoring kids at the local high school. Anything so they don't have to sit there looking at each other."
He had two brothers, both older. One ran a Mercedes dealership just outside Weymouth, Massachusetts, and another who's an accountant, like my sister. They were a close family and competitive, and he had hated his brothers with the impotent fury of a tortured youngest sibling until they left home, after which he found he missed them with a gnawing and unexpected pain.
"Mom says it was because I lost my yardstick, the thing I judged everything by."
Both brothers were now married and settled with two kids apiece. The family converged for holidays, and every summer they rented the same house in Nantucket. In his teens he had resented it, but now it was a week he looked forward to more each year.
"It's great, the kids and the hanging out and the boat. You should come," he said, casually forking char siu bao into his mouth.
He talked without self-consciousness, a man used to things working out the way he wanted them to.
"To a family thing? I thought men in New York were all about casual dating." "Yeah, well, I've done that. And besides, I'm not from New York."
He was a man who seemingly threw himself at everything. He worked a million hours a week, was hungry for promotion, and went to the gym before 6 a.m. He played baseball with the office team and was thinking about volunteering to mentor at a local high school, like his mother did, but was worried that his work schedule meant he couldn't commit to a regular time. He was shot through with the American dream, like a stick of rock. You worked hard, you succeeded, and then you gave back. I tried not to keep drawing comparisons with Will. I listened to him and felt half admiring, half exhausted. He drew a picture of his future in the air between us, an apartment in the village, maybe a weekend place in the Hamptons if he could get his bonuses to the right level. He wanted a boat. He wanted kids. He wanted to retire early. He wanted to make $1 million before he was 30. He punctuated much of this talk with the waving of chopsticks and the phrase, "You should come," or "You'd love it." And I was partly flattered, but mostly grateful that this implied he wasn't offended by my earlier reticence. He left at 10:30, since he planned to get up at 5, and we stood in the hallway by the front door with Dean Martin on guard a few feet away.
"So are we going to be able to squeeze in lunch, what with the whole dog and hospital thing?"
"We could perhaps see each other one evening,"
We could perhaps see each other one evening, he mimicked softly.
I love your English accent.
I haven't got an accent, I said.
You have. And you make me laugh. Not many girls make me laugh.
Oh, then you've just not met the right girls.
Oh, I think I have.
He stopped talking then and looked up to the heavens as if he were trying to prevent himself doing something. And then he smiled, as if acknowledging the slight ridiculousness of two adults nearing their 30s, trying not to kiss in a doorway. But it was the smile that did it for me. I reached up and touched the back of his neck, very lightly. And then I went up on tiptoe and kissed him. I told myself there was no point in dwelling on something that was gone. I told myself 2 weeks was certainly long enough to make a decision, especially when you had barely seen that other person for months beforehand and had pretty much been single anyway. I told myself I had to move on. Josh didn't hesitate. He kissed me back, his hands sliding slowly up my spine, manoeuvring me against the wall so that I was pinned pleasurably against him. He kissed me and I made myself stop thinking and just gave in to sensation. His unfamiliar body, narrower and slightly harder than the one I had known, the intensity of his mouth on mine. This handsome American. We were both a little dazed when we came up for air. "If I don't go now," he said, stepping back and blinked hard, raising his hand to the back of his head. I grinned. I suspected my lipstick was halfway across my face. "You have an early start, so I'll speak to you tomorrow." I opened the door, and with a last kiss on my cheek, he stepped out into the main corridor. When I closed it, Dean Martin was still staring at me.
"What?"
I said.
"What? I'm single."
He lowered his head in disgust, turned, and potted towards the kitchen. Chapter 23 From bumblebeeinny@gmail.com to Mr. and Mrs. Bernard Clark at yahoo.com.
Hi, Mum. Lovely to hear that you and Maria had such a nice tea at Fortnum and Mason on Maria's birthday. Although, yes, I agree, that is a lot for a packet of biscuits, and I'm sure both you and Maria could do better scones at home. Yours are very light. And no, the toilet thing in the theatre was not good. I'm sure as an attendant herself, she has a very keen eye for things like that. I'm glad someone is looking out for all your hygiene needs.
All fine here. New York is pretty chilly right now. But you know me, clothing for every occasion. There are a few things up in the air at work, but hopefully all will be sorted by the time we speak. And yes, I'm totally fine about Sam. Just one of those things indeed. Sorry to hear about Grandad. I hope when he's feeling better you can start your night classes again. I miss you all. A lot. Lots of love. Lou. Kiss, kiss. P.S. Probably best if you email or write to me via Nathan just now as we're having some issues with the post. Mrs. DeWitt came out of hospital 10 days after she was admitted, squinting in the unfamiliar daylight, her right arm in a plaster cast that seemed too heavy for her thin frame. I brought her home in a taxi. Ashok met her at the curb and helped her slowly up the steps. For once she didn't crab at him or bat him away, but walked gingerly, as if balance were no longer a given. I had brought the outfit she'd demanded, a 1970s pale blue Celine trouser suit, a daffodil yellow blouse, and a pale pink wool beret, with some of the cosmetics that were on her dresser, and sat on the side of her hospital bed to help her apply them. She said her own attempts with her left hand made her look like she'd drunk 3 sidecars for breakfast. Dean Martin, delighted, jogged and snuffled at her heels, looking up at her, then back at me pointedly, as if to tell me I could leave now. We had reached something of a truce, the dog and I. He ate his meals and curled up on my lap every evening, and I think he had even started to enjoy the slightly faster pace and longer reach of our walks, because his little tail wagged wildly whenever he saw me pick up the lead. Mrs. DeWitt was overjoyed to see him, if joyousness could be conveyed by a series of complaints about my obvious mismanagement of his care, by the fact that within a space of 12 hours she had deemed him both over and underweight, and by an ongoing crooning apology to him for leaving him in my inadequate hands.
"Poor baby, did I leave you with a stranger? I did. And she didn't care for you properly. It's okay. Mama's home now. It's all okay."
She was plainly delighted to be home, but I can't pretend I wasn't anxious. She seemed to require a prodigious number of pills,
even by American standards, and I wondered if she had some kind of brittle bone syndrome. It seemed an awful lot for a broken wrist. I told Trina, who said in England you would have been prescribed a couple of painkillers and told not to lift anything heavy, and laughed heartily. But Mrs. DeWitt, I felt, had been left even frailer by her time in hospital. She was pale and coughed repeatedly, and her tailored clothes gaped in odd places around her body. When I cooked her macaroni cheese, she ate 4 or 5 neat mouthfuls and pronounced it delicious, but declined to eat any more.
I think my stomach shrank in that awful place, possibly trying to shut itself off from their abysmal food.
She took half a day to reacquaint herself fully with her apartment, tottering slowly from room to room, reminding and reassuring herself that everything was as it should be. I tried not to view this as her checking I hadn't stolen anything. Finally, she sat down on her tall, upholstered chair and let out a little sigh.
"I can't tell you how good it is to be home."
She said it as if she had half expected not to make it back, and then she nodded off. I thought for the 100th time about Grandad, and how lucky he was to have Mum caring for him. Mrs. DeWitt was plainly too frail to be left alone, and apparently in no hurry to see me go. So, with no actual discussion between us, I simply stayed on. I helped her wash and dress and cooked her meals, and for the first week at least, walked Dean Martin several times a day. Towards the end of that week, I found she had cleared me a little space in the 4th bedroom, moving books and items of clothing one at a time, to reveal a bedside table that was usable, or a shelf on which I could put my things. I commandeered her guest bathroom for myself, scrubbing it thoroughly and running the taps until the water was clear. Then, discreetly, I set about cleaning all those areas of her own bathroom and kitchen that her failing eyesight had begun to miss. I took her to the hospital for her follow-up appointments and sat outside with Dean Martin until I was asked to return for her. I booked her an appointment at a hairdresser and waited while her thin, silvery hair was returned to its form in neat waves, a small act that seemed to be more restorative than any of the medical attention she had received. I helped her with her makeup and located her various pairs of glasses. She would thank me quietly and emphatically for my help in the way you might a favoured guest. Conscious that, as she'd lived alone for years, she might need her space, I would often go out for a few hours in the day, sit in the library and look for jobs, but without the urgency I had felt previously, and, in truth, there was nothing I wanted to do. She would usually be either sleeping or propped in front of her television when I returned.
"Now, Louisa," she would say,
pushing herself upright, as if we had been mid-conversation.
"I'd been wondering where you were. Would you be kind enough to take Dean Martin for a little stroll? He's been looking rather concerned."
On Saturdays, I went with Mina to the library protests. The crowds had grown thinner now, the library's future dependent not just on public support, but a crowd-funded legal challenge. Nobody seemed to hold out much hope for it. We stood, less chilled as each week passed, waving our battered placards and accepting with thanks the hot drinks and snacks that still arrived from neighbours and local shopkeepers. I'd learnt to look out for familiar faces, the grandmother I'd met on my first visit, whose name was Martine, and now greeted me with a hug and a broad smile. A handful of others waved or said hi. The security guard, the woman who brought pecoras, the librarian with the beautiful hair. I never saw the old woman with the ripped epaulettes again. I had been living in Mrs. DeWitt's apartment for 13 days when I bumped into Agnes. Given our proximity to each other, I suppose it was surprising that it hadn't happened earlier. It was raining heavily, and I was wearing one of Mrs. DeWitt's old raincoats, a yellow and orange 1970s plastic one with bright circular flowers all over it, and she had put a little Macintosh with an elevated hood on Dean Martin, which made me snort with laughter every time I looked at it. We ran along the corridor, me giggling at the sight of his bulbous little face under the plastic hood, and I stopped suddenly as the lift opened and Agnes stepped out, tailed by a young woman with an iPad, her hair scraped back into a tight ponytail. She stopped and stared at me. Something not quite readable passed across her face, something that might have been awkwardness, a mute apology, or even suppressed fury at my being there. It was hard to tell. Her eyes met mine. She opened her mouth as if to speak, then pressed her lips together and walked past me as if she hadn't seen me. Her glossy blonde hair swinging, and the girl close behind. I stood watching as the front door closed emphatically after them, my cheeks burning like a spurned lover's. I had a vague memory of us laughing in a noodle bar. Are we friends, Louisa? And then I took a deep breath, called the little dog to me to fasten his lead, and headed out into the rain. In the end, it was the girls at the Vintage Clothes Emporium who offered me paid employment. A container of stuff was arriving from Florida, several wardrobes worth, and they needed an extra pair of hands to go over each item before it hit the shelves. Sew on missing buttons and make sure everything that went out on the rails was steam-pressed and clean in time for a vintage clothes fair at the end of April. Articles that didn't smell fresh were the most commonly returned. The pay was minimum wage, but the company was good, the coffee free, and they would give me a 20% discount on anything I wanted to buy. My appetite for purchasing new clothes had diminished along with my lack of accommodation, but I said yes gladly, and once I was sure Mrs. DeWitt was stable enough to walk Dean Martin, at least to the end of the block and back by herself, I would head to the store every Tuesday at 10 a.m. and spend the day in their back room, cleaning, sewing and chatting to the girls during their cigarette breaks, which seemed to happen every 15 minutes or so. Margot, I was forbidden to call her Mrs. DeWitt anymore, you're living in my home, for goodness sake, listened carefully when I told her of my new role, then asked what I was using to repair the clothes. I described the huge plastic box of old buttons and zips, but added that the whole thing was such a chaotic mess that I often couldn't find a match, and rarely more than three of the same type of button. She rose heavily from her chair and motioned to me to follow. I walked very close to her these days. She didn't seem completely steady on her feet, and frequently listed to one side, like a badly loaded ship in high seas. But she made it, her hand trailing the wall for extra stability. Under that bed, dear. No, there. There are two chests. That's it. I knelt and wrenched out two heavy wooden boxes with lids. Opening them, I found them filled to the brim with rows of buttons, zips, tapes and fringes. There were hooks and eyes, fastenings of every type, all neatly separated and labelled. Brass naval buttons and tiny Chinese ones, covered with bright silk, bone and shell, sewn neatly onto little strips of card. In the cushioned lid sat sprays of pins, rows of different sized needles, and an assortment of silk threads on tiny pegs. I ran my fingers across them reverently. I was given those for my 14th birthday. My grandfather had them shipped from Hong Kong. If you get stuck, you can check in there. I used to take the buttons and zippers from everything I didn't wear anymore, you know. That way, if you lose a button on something nice and can't replace it, you always have a full set that you can sew on instead.
But won't you need them?
She waved her good hand.
Oh, my fingers are far too clumsy for sewing now. Half the time I can't even work the buttonholes. And so few people bother with fixing buttons and zippers these days. They just throw their clothes into the trash and buy something awful from one of those discount stores. You take them, dear. It would be nice to feel they were useful.
So, by luck, and perhaps a little by design, I had two jobs that I loved. And with them, I found a kind of contentment. Every Tuesday evening, I would bring home a few items of clothing in a checkered laundry bag of plastic webbing, and while Margot napped or watched television, I would carefully remove all the remaining buttons on each item and sew on a new set, holding them up afterwards for her approval.
"You sew quite nicely,"
she remarked, peering at my stitches through her spectacles as we sat in front of Wheel of Fortune.
"I thought you'd be as dreadful at it as you are at everything else."
At school, needlework was pretty much the only thing I was any good at. I smoothed out the creases on my lap and prepared to refold a jacket.
"I was just the same," she said. "By 13, I was making all my own clothes. My mother showed me how to cut a pattern, and that was it. I was away. I became obsessed with fashion."
"What was it you did, Margot?" I put down my stitching.
I was fashion editor of the Ladies' Look. It doesn't exist now, never made it into the 90s. But we were around for 30 years or more, and I was fashion editor for most of that.
Is that the magazine in the frames, the ones on the wall?
Yes, those were my favorite covers. I was rather sentimental and kept a few.
Her face softened briefly, and she tilted her head, casting me a confiding look.
It was quite the job back then, you know. The magazine company wasn't terribly keen on having women in senior roles, but there was the most dreadful man in charge of the fashion pages, and my editor, a wonderful man, Mr. Aldridge, argued that having an old fuddy-duddy who still wore suspenders to hold up his socks, dictating what fashion meant, simply wouldn't work with the younger girls. He thought I had an eye for it, promoted me, and that was that.
So that's why you have so many beautiful clothes.
Well, I certainly didn't marry rich.
Did you marry at all? She looked down and picked at something on her knee.
Goodness, you do ask a lot of questions.
Yes, I did. A lovely man. Terence. He worked in publishing. But he died in 1962, 3 years after we were married, and that was it for me.
You never wanted children?
I had a son, dear, but not with my husband. Is that what you wanted to know?
I flushed. No, I mean, not like that. Having children is... I mean, I wouldn't presume to...
Stop flapping, Louisa. I fell in love with someone unsuitable when I was grieving my husband and I became pregnant. I had the baby, but it caused a bit of a stir, and in the end it was considered better for everyone if my parents brought him up in Westchester.
Where is he now?
Still in Westchester, as far as I know.
I blinked.
You don't see him?
Oh, I did. I saw him every weekend and vacation for the whole of his childhood. But once he reached adolescence, he grew rather angry with me for not being the kind of mother he thought I should be. I had to make a choice, you see. In those days, if you married or had children, you weren't allowed to keep your job. And I chose work. I honestly felt I would die without it. And Frank, my boss, supported me.
She sighed.
Unfortunately, my son has never really forgiven me.
There was a long silence.
I'm so sorry.
Yes, so am I. But what's done is done, and there's no point dwelling.
She began to cough, so I poured her a glass of water and handed it to her. She motioned towards a bottle of pills that she kept on the sideboard, and I waited while she swallowed one. She settled herself again like a hen that had ruffled her feathers.
What was his name? I asked when she had recovered.
More questions.
Frank Jr.